Planning on stealing our boat?
No. Just looking.
Who are you people? We were just getting ready to shove off. Did Summer send you?
No. Don't know him. We were just looking to head up the coast. Man told us boats could be bought here. The way you're acting, don't guess yours is for sale.
Got that right. Who are you?
J.B. Dix. The lady's Mildred. Old guy's Doc Tanner. And the teenager Jack.
Name's Gardner Boyd.
The man jerked a thumb toward the behemoth standing to his left and behind.
This here's Frank Bowman. He don't say much. I do all the talking.
I guessed that. You look like the genius of the couple.
Nobody asked you, bitch.
Mildred's face was carved in stone as she glared back at the man.
Oh, you stepped in it now, friend. You're dead.
We'll see about that. I know your black bitch ain't gonna be the one chilling me, so she might as well get over it and stop staring at me like that.
Boyd was all angles, sharp and pointy. His chin, his nose, even his ears. He had close-cropped black hair and a three-day growth of bristly beard. His eyes were bloodshot and brown. JB put him at just under 6 feet tall. His arms and legs were gangly, coming off a long torso. He was dressed in a light green wool cap set back on the crown of his head like a skullcap, a navy blue shirt with four rows of buttons stitched up the front, a faded pair of denim pants, and canvas sneakers. The big man, Bowman, was round. Round face, round belly, and a round, slack-jawed mouth that didn't utter a sound beyond a slight asthmatic wheeze. He was nearly bald, with a smattering of bright orange hair gathered in clumps along the sides of his head. Boyd was holding a handgun, Bowman an oddly shaped pump-action shotgun. Both weapons appeared flawless and well-maintained.
Nice guns. 9mm Heckler & Koch P7 semi-auto. Weighs in at right under 2 pounds. Old-style policemen and the German army were big on the H&K.
I like it. Does the job.
Well, that's an Italian Franchi Spaz 12 shotgun. Wicked dark gun. Semi-auto. Designed for paramilitary use and sec work. The butt of the pistol grip can hook under your arm for single-handed firing. 8-shot magazine. Weighted right between 9.5 and 10 pounds, according to the old spec manuals.
Boyd listened to the dissertation while peering at JB as if the armorer were some sort of fedora-wearing alien insect.
Looks like we got us a real know-it-all. Maybe the Admiral would like to have a chat with such a gushing font of wisdom.
Boyd looked to Bowman for confirmation. The big man's face spoke for him. He looked as though he couldn't care less one way or the other.
Gushing font? What the hell kind of phrase is that? You some kind of pansy?
Wouldn't you like to know?
What are you gents doing here anyway?
Why, we're doing the Lord's work. The good Lord Poseidon. You might say we're his loyal disciples. Yes, sir, we're loyal. Steadfast and true. Preaching his wisdom up and down the coast, aren't we, Frankie?
Bowman shrugged his massive shoulders.
If you say so.
You know something? You're no fun at all, you know that?
Get over it.
Well, sorry to interrupt your spat, but there's something I need to tell you.
Did I ask your opinion, Four Eyes?
Again with the Four Eyes? We've got to get you some contacts, John.
Oh, what is it? I can tell you right now the answer's hell no.
Don't have a question, just an observation. There's one other thing you ought to know about those H&K semi-auto pistols.
Yeah? And what's that, genius?
Their most interesting feature is the long safety lever at the front of the grip. You have to hold it firmly before the gun can fire. And guess what? You're not holding it.
When Ryan heard the distinctive bark of Mildred ZKR, he, Christy, and Dean immediately started to race toward the source of the sound.
Move!
Ryan hit the brakes and flattened his body against one of the damp marina walls that separated the twin docks. Christy and Dean almost collided, but managed to follow suit.
Sounded like a shotgun lover.
Yeah.
Ryan mentally made himself count to 20 before peering around the corner. Nothing. He walked briskly to the next bend in the wooden frame tunnel, the tar paper roofs flapping in the strong sea winds. Ryan stopped at the next corner and took up a position, waving Christy and Dean over.
Anything?
No, feels fine.
Okay then.
Ryan leaned over and peered down an alley of boat slips. First he saw the patch, then he saw his friends. JB was looking back at Ryan, knowing the gunshots would bring the one-eyed man running.
What took you so damn long?
You didn't chill him?
Ryan looked down at the heap where Bowman was sprawled. The hair hanging over his forehead was plastered down with sweat.
Nope.
Why not?
Shoot. Didn't want to hear Christy complain.
Don't mistake compassion for cowardice, Jack.
You two are arguing for nothing.
Mildred examined Bowman's wound.
I can't do anything for this man. He'll be dead in minutes.
If you hadn't shielded Void between the eyes, he might have told us something we could use. Can't blame you, though. Knew the black bitch crack was his signature on the death certificate.
Where's Boyd now?
Fell overboard.
Hear that?
Ryan spoke to the dying man at his feet.
Your last few minutes can go easy or harsh. Answer a few questions about your boat, and we won't toss you in alive.
I want to know about this Poseidon we heard about earlier, and Summers.
He does not look much like a sailor to me. From his corpulent midsection, all I can think of is Captain Bligh, except that our friend has proved he lacks the proper intelligence required to be a proper despot.
Yeah, the brains of the pair is that triple stoop floating face down next to the boat.
J.B. gestured to the side of the dock, where Boyd's corpse was bobbing lifelessly in the water.
I know your charming companion did most of the talking, but I suggest you come up with why you two are here.
Ferryboat. Supposed to get supplies from Summers and then head back home.
Home? Where's that? Farther south or on up the coast?
The dying man didn't respond. Jack gave him a sharp kick in the ample waistline.
He asked a question.
Upstate. We're supposed to pick up package, but it was a fixed deal. Summers was running a scam. No warhead.
Warhead?
Where upstate?
Bowman's eyes were still open, but they had gone from the wide bulge of pain and suffering to a glassy and lifeless stare. Each of the companions stood on the dock, pondering the meaning of the man's last word.
Warhead? I wonder what he was planning on carrying around in that tub.
Since it's our ride out of here, we might as well take a look.
Warhead? Sounds triple deadly.
It is, son. It is.
Ryan winced as the darkness surrounding him turned to blinding white light. His right eye strained to focus on the helm controls in front of him as a blast of thunder followed the lightning. A deafening crash, so close he could feel the damp air press sharply on his eardrums.
Fire blast.
Ryan peered out into the night through the rain-streaked windows of the boat's bridge. Ryan Carter was many things, but a seaman wasn't one of them. He had spent time on boats, but never long enough to learn the intricacies. Unfortunately, none of the others on board the spacious 100-foot cruiser were nautically inclined either.
I can't see a damn thing.
Nothing to see.
I've never liked boats. I'd rather swim to the Carolinas than try and sail around in this mess.
You first.
At least the rain's clean. Glad this isn't a chem storm. We'd be screwed face down to the boards with our asses in the air then.
Ain't that the truth?
Both men had driven through enough of those hellish nuclear-spawned aberrations of nature to know their dangers.
This boat not take much more of this.
Jack's red eyes were shining eerily in the glow of the flickering electric lamps of the yacht's bridge as he stood in the doorway across from Ryan, his wet mane of white hair hanging limply around his skull like sodden tendrils. Ryan glanced away from the windows of the craft and over at the teenager. Ryan couldn't help but notice that while he was struggling to keep his footing, Jack was standing effortlessly and compensating for the roll of the deck.
The boat will do fine, Jack. Just gotta hang on until this is over. How are things below?
Fine. Doc's seasick.
No surprise there. Doc's usually the one who pukes whenever we make a jump.
Tell everybody to hang on. There's not much else I can do but try and keep the wheel steady until we ride this thing out.
At the moment, Ryan thought that the nightmares generated by a jump were more appealing than the wild ride the companions were enduring. And then, almost involuntarily, his mind turned back to the peaceful scene of a few hours earlier. After they left the marina, the rest of the night had passed without incident. Morning brought up a deep orange jewel from the horizon, as if the ball of the sun had been plucked from the waters of the ocean. The course had been set by utilizing JB's mini-sextant, some trigonometric tables left in the crumbling manual for a malfunctioning onboard navigation comp, and some worn and taped but still intact charts. Ryan was glad for JB's knowledge. They would have been forced to set out blindly in a generally northward direction otherwise. The cruiser was making way northward, with the destination of North Carolina's Outer Banks as a stopping point. For all of the talk of a warhead, there were no weapons on board beyond what the group had carried on. A box of ammunition for Boyd's 9mm Heckler & Koch P7 semi-auto pistol was found on a table, but the gun had fallen into the water with its owner when Mildred killed him. Dean had claimed Bowman's Italian Frankie Spaz 12 shotgun and stuck it under one of the boat's bunks for safekeeping. The galley of the craft was the only amenity lacking on the tidy patch. Empty packages and peelings in a trash can hinted of the previous existence of canned and fresh foodstuffs, such as tinned meats, apples, and peaches. Now most of the cabinets were bare, except for staple rations of stale wheat crackers, a plastic bag of jerky, and part of a case of 12-ounce tins of water. Ryan's long arm had swept the back of the cabinets and come up with a glass container of green beans. Doc had pondered doing some fishing, but instead spent most of the trip on his back, exhausted from the trek across Florida and nauseated from the ship. An informal series of watches had been set, with some of the group sleeping during the day and others at nightfall. The sunset was as strikingly beautiful as the sunrise. As a rule, sunsets were always spectacular in Deathlands due to the pollutants and the chemicals, and to some degree, the radiation still hovering in the upper atmosphere. Doc had finally ventured into the evening breeze, his feelings of nausea passing with the coming of night. He was wide awake and restless, and since Jack and Christy were below sleeping, their watches over, he really had no choice but to try to socialize. The sky around the patch was strikingly clear, the night open and beautiful, with a multitude of stars stretching out across the horizon. Ryan hadn't seen such celestial beauty in a long time, not since the long summer nights in the mountains of his boyhood. Back then, he'd spent many an hour outdoors, the dew wet and cold beneath his bare feet, looking at the sky and trying to sort out the stars from the glowing lightning bugs. Doc, taking strength from being revved up in full educator mode, had been challenging JB and Mildred to a friendly game of naming the constellations. Unlike the knowledge necessary to comprehend his numerous literary aspersions, the spouting of which put Doc in a class all by himself, both the physician and the armorer knew a bit about the stars in the heavens. With JB's eidetic memory, they were matching Doc, constellation for constellation. Usually, JB's mental expertise only came into play when he used the mini-sextant to get a reading on their position, or when he was spouting out a series of specs for a piece of hardware. Ryan knew they were enjoying giving Doc a run for the old man's money. He hadn't seen his old partner this happy in a long time. Across from them, flat on his back in a swaying rope hammock with his hands behind his head, was Dean. For once, the boy was staying silent and not asking questions.
Why aren't you in there with Mildred and JB trying to stump Doc? Are you falling asleep in that rigging?
Don't know any constellations.
Watch and learn, then. Pretend you're back in school.
Those days are over. Triple glad to be back with you, Dad. Glad to have the excitement. Thought I'd go crazy sitting at a desk all day.
There's more to life than roaming the countryside, and the world can change. You never know when things come in handy. Besides, if you know your stars, you can always get some kind of directional fix no matter where you are. That's how JB does it at night when he doesn't have the sun to go by.
JB's got a sharp memory.
For some things. We can all remember stuff we want to. You remember Sharona, don't you?
Yeah, she was my mom.
Remember what she looked like, what she liked to wear? What kinds of food she liked to eat, and how she took care of you?
Yeah.
You think you'll ever forget?
No, not even when I'm chilled and gone.
There you go. You hold things in your memory you need, or that mean something to you, or both. The stars might save your life, son. Keep it in mind, and learn.
Ah, my dear Ryan, perhaps you would like to join our little competition. I am in need of a partner, since I am currently being double-teamed by the good Dr. Wyeth and her friend, who seems to know all of the answers.
I'll pass, Doc. You seem to be holding your own, though.
So much has changed in my life, but the stars have always remained.
Yeah, too bad you can't recollect half their names.
For all of her chiding, Mildred understood precisely what Doc was saying, and in many ways shared the same sense of loss. Mildred was a time traveler of a different sort than Doc. Unlike the violent time-trawling that had ripped Doc from the bosom of his family and career, she had undergone her one-way journey to Deathlands in an entirely different fashion. Mildred was a leading expert in the field of cryogenics by the time she was in her early 30s. A few short years later, she was admitted to the hospital for a routine operation 3 days before the advent of the year 2001. During the surgery, the anesthetic triggered a near-fatal reaction. To save her life, the physicians used Mildred's own experimental techniques to freeze and place the woman into suspended animation. where she had remained until Ryan and the others found and awakened her. Surprisingly, the cryonic process had reversed the negative effects of the anesthetic. The constellation game was interrupted when the first signs of the storm arrived in the slender form of Christy, who had been unable to continue sleeping below.
Air is wrong. There's a storm coming. A bad one.
Ryan was dubious, as the night sky was cloud-free, but he knew from past experience not to dismiss any of Christy's feelings. Her exterior might reveal nothing more than a tall, strikingly beautiful woman, but what lurked behind her intelligent emerald eyes was more than human. Nothing was ever what it seemed to be in Deathlands, and Christy was living proof. Christy Roth was a mutant. One of her powers was the empathic ability to sense danger, whether from man or nature. Her vibrant mane of fiery red hair was the outward manifestation of this power, stirring, curling, moving as if it were a separate sentient organism as she became entranced with the vision of a premonition. It was a handy ability that had saved their lives more than once.
Let me take a look, see what the instruments say.
Ryan walked over and checked the old-style brass barometer mounted on the exterior bulkhead. He tapped the glass and frowned. The needle was showing 25.5 inches of mercury. Christy was right. Between the needle's drop and the stillness in the air, even a lander like Ryan knew they were in for a bad spell.
Oh dear. That does not look good at all, my friend.
No, it doesn't.
The party broke up quickly after that. Jack was awakened and given the bad news. The good feeling shared quickly dissolved into the tension of worry with the discovery of the upcoming storm.
I knew this peaceful scene was too good to last.
Mildred led JB down below decks. Doc, Jack, Dean, and Christy followed, all staying close to the handrail along the passageway. Already the seas were becoming choppy.
Why do we have to slink down here, hiding out like a bunch of scared night stalkers at sunrise?
Don't let your father hear you talking like that. He's doing the right thing.
Why isn't he coming then?
Ryan knows if we're below, we're safe. He doesn't have to worry about anyone being thrown overboard or hit by lightning or falling down on the deck and breaking a leg. This way, he can fully focus on keeping us on course.
Yeah, I guess you're right, Christy. Still sucks, though.
I must stress, even at this early juncture, that your slang is most vile, young Cotter. But I have to agree, this does indeed suck.
Doc, you look even paler than usual. What's wrong?
Oh, nothing, Dr. Wyeth. Put away your medical bag.
You've been acting funny since we came on board. If I didn't know better, I'd say you were...
seasick, right, Doc?
Affirmative.
Doc stumbled over and sat down on a folding chair. Both man and chair wobbled as the boat encountered choppier waters.
Glass stomach's bad. Wasting jumping.
As you might recall, young Lauren, I am usually not the only one stricken during our Mattrans excursions.
You're the only one turning green now.
As long minutes turned into hours, all of the comrades knew the storm wasn't getting any better. Rather than turn back, Ryan and JB decided to sail farther inland in an attempt to avoid the demon storm clouds that had been bearing down on them mercilessly. A good plan, but it didn't make for an easy voyage. Still, all was quiet and seemingly uneventful inside the long stateroom when Christy suddenly bolted upright from the bunk she was resting on.
What?
Christy didn't answer, her green eyes wide as she took in the room, looking but not comprehending what she was staring at in the real world. She was somewhere else.
Something wrong, Christy?
Maybe so. I wonder if everything's okay above.
I'll take a look. Be back soon.
Woe is me, for I shall never take another sea voyage for as long as I shall live. I have nothing left to give. My stomach is empty, cursed sickness. Shall I donate a vital organ to your lust for watching me suffer?
Quiet, Doc. I've got to concentrate.
There was a new menace, an unnatural threat beyond the storm in the thrashing sea. This threat was man-made, but of what type, Christy couldn't tell. Her latent muti senses had been in turmoil since they had left port in Florida. Drawing much of her inner strength from the land itself, Christy never felt at ease when on water anyway, and she had attributed her feelings to that.
Something's wrong. Something's bad wrong.
Mildred got up and reached over to feel the redhead's sweaty brow.
God, Christy, you're on fire.
Got to warn Ryan, there's danger. I'm seeing red. Blood red.
What kind of danger? The storm?
Christy was thrown off her feet and onto her upper back and neck. The suddenness of the explosion smashed her down with terrific force, knocking her instantly unconscious as she slid toward the gaping hole that had just appeared in the hull. Jack, who had been coming back down the companionway into the lower part of the boat when the blast occurred, didn't have a second to react as he was thrown forward down the narrow passageway and directly into the newly created hole.
Jack
twisted his live body as he fell, managing not to break his neck when he hit the churning water. He struggled to maintain some kind of proper sense of which way was up. Seeing Christy's limp body already being sucked into the undertow beneath the vessel, he pushed himself down farther, under the chilling ocean, and grabbed a fistful of long red hair. On the deck of the craft, Ryan had turned the controls over to JB seconds before the blast. The one-eyed man was hurled into a console, and he grabbed for purchase, trying to stay on his feet.
What the fuck was that? You hit a rock?
Out here? No way. That was an explosion of some kind.
Who would try and attack us in the middle of this?
No one. We must have hit a mine.
Then we're going down. Find the life rafts. I'm going below to check on the others. Don't worry about the controls. We're triple screwed now anyway. I don't think we're going to crash into another boat out here alone in this mess.
On it.
JB headed onto the unprotected deck and into the full brunt of the storm. Already the yacht was starting to list badly, and the stern was beginning to rise on an incline as the lower hull took on water. Whipping whitecaps were everywhere across the surface of the churning ocean. The increased activity caused heavy seas to spring up and crash down over the patch's bow, sending shudders down the length of the boat's hull. Ryan entered the stairwell that led to the galleon berths.
Ryan!
Mildred was trying to help a pained Doc up the steps. Below Doc, Dean was pushing the old man by the buttocks. A look of sheer panic was pasted on the boy's face. Ryan reached down past the struggling Milbert and snatched Doc by the collar of his frock coat, boldly pulling the other man up with one hand. Coasting on adrenaline, Ryan stared past his son and realized that no one else was coming.
Where's Christy? Where's Christy and Jack?
She went under, through the hole. She was limp, had to be unconscious. Jack fell in after her, but at least he was alert and awake. I think he was trying to grab her.
Mildred had known Ryan for some time now, and she'd seen him caught up in the throes of any and all emotions. Usually, his face was a mask. The only way to judge any emotional turmoil was to look at the color of the long scar that stretched from his eye to his chin. The more upset Ryan got, the redder the scar would pulse. This time, even the scar was ghostly white. Ryan spun back up and away from Mildred. He spotted a dirty coil of rope hanging beside the companionway and snatched it off the hook. He ran out onto the deck of the ship. Ryan tossed his pistol to JB.
Hold this!
Ryan began to quickly tie the rope around his waist. By now, the boat had a near 30-degree angle, with the nose beginning to rise high in the night air. JB was carrying a tight bundle of plastic.
Only one raft, but it's big. Should hold us all.
He paused, noting the absence of Christy and Jack.
Where's...
Overboard! Get that raft up and everybody in it. I'm going over, but I'll need an anchor so I can find my way back.
JB pulled a cord, and the raft began to fill with compressed air. Once Ryan could see that the old pre-dark inflating mechanism wasn't going to malfunction, he handed his oldest living friend the end of the rope.
Tie this to the raft.
We've lost him, Ryan. You'll never find her in this muck.
I've got to try.
Below the surface, the water was no calmer. The sea churned all around, and Ryan's sense of direction was compromised. A vision from his dream in the Matran's chamber rushed into his mind's eye. In that vision, the water had been much clearer and had color. Ryan realized that the vision had been wrong. The ocean was neither green nor blue. The ocean was black. Not far away from the sinking yacht, down lower on the Georgia coastline, in a tiny, dimly lit room crowded with blinking lights and computer equipment, a white blip appeared on a normally blank sonar screen. The sight was so unusual, the crew-cut man seated in front of the screen rubbed his eyes in disbelief. A blip meant something big was going down. At least that was what his training had told him. The antiquated gear in the room was prone to hiccups, such as this one, in their attempts to register phantoms in the deep. Normally, no one would have even been in this chamber, but there was a test in progress, a preliminary run. As such, he felt his duty required him to pass this information along to his commanding officer. In the days before the nuke cost, this was known as passing the buck.
Sir?
Yes?
You might want to check this.
The man approached. He was dressed in the same type of uniform, with tan pressed slacks and a short-sleeved buttoned-up shirt of the same color. He was also wearing an embossed name tag that read Brosnan.
What is it now, Regis?
Something set off one of the mines.
Second one this month, both times during tests. Wondered what triggered it this time.
Don't know, sir. Maybe another one of those weird-ass muty fish.
Maybe. Maybe not.
That's what I think.
Weather reports a hell of a storm blasting across the water out there. The mine was hit by lightning, no doubt. Or maybe you're actually right and it was another one of those mutant fish. They seem to be becoming a problem. I think the communication buoys we put out there are drawing them in somehow.
Lightning? Sure. No doubt. Sounds good. So I guess you'll be the one answering to the Admiral if you're wrong.
Brosnan considered it for a moment. He was second in command to the Admiral, but the title was merely a formality given for his loyalty and seniority. The title also came because Brosnan knew not to make even the slightest move without consulting with his master first. Brosnan picked up the microphone at the far end of the room and pressed the send key.
Mothman 1, this is Base. I need to speak to the Admiral.
Mr. Brosnan, I requested radio silence. You were supposed to track and observe, not talk.
Yes, sir, I know, but something's triggered one of the mines across the bay. Thought you might want to have a look, seeing as how you were already out that way.
Our own sensors already caught the explosion, and we're almost at the site now. Is there anything else?
No, sir. Brosnan out.
Wonder what he thinks set it off.
Brosnan didn't answer. They would both hear about this when the Admiral returned to port. The yellow life raft bobbed in the ocean, a life-saving cork of inflated plastic and canvas. In the raft, in varying degrees of condition from the ordeal of the night before, were JB, Dean, Mildred, and Doc. Ryan was also seated in the raft, but on the other side, as far away from human contact as he could manage in the limited quarters. All of them were sodden with seawater, but their clothing was rapidly starting to dry out in the heat of the sun. Each person in the raft was silent. Each one adrift physically, but also mentally, in his or her own private thoughts and memories.
Not quite 10 o'clock. Gonna be another hot one.
At least it stopped raining.
How are the knees, Doc?
Better. I should be able to walk and skip once more if, or should I say when, we reach dry land. Between that horrible bloodsucker back in the swamps and my unfortunate fall last night, I could certainly use the steadying support of my walking stick.
Here, you babbling old fool. I was able to get this down the side of my jeans before the shit hit the fan.
Mildred caught a brief, almost imperceptible look of pain across Ryan's face. His countenance quickly returned to its frozen, stoic calm. Ryan was scared of what might happen once he did show emotion.
My walking stick! Woman, you have produced a feat of sleight of hand that even the greatest of stage illusionists could not hope to compete with. Perhaps I will allow you to win the next argument between the two of us.
Yeah, well, try not to poke yourself, or the raft.
John Barrymore, I assure you, this finely hewn blade of Toledo steel will taste nothing but the rich ichor of our foes.
Who'd mind this stretch, JP? It doesn't make sense.
I know it doesn't make any sense. Naval mines are usually on the ocean floor or anchored to it. You keep the damn things floating around freely, they're completely unpredictable. What hit us had to be a contact mine. Old ordnance.
Not that old. It still worked.
Hell, Ryan, it might have been floating out here since pre-dark. No telling what might have fallen overboard or been dredged up when the bombs fell. Once everything fell about, predictions went south. We've run into enough unexplained crap to prove that ourselves.
Shit, JB. The coast of Georgia wasn't exactly a strategic site. Are they trying to keep it safe for tourism?
Didn't say it was strategic. Just gave my theory why the fragger might have been out where it was when it detonated.
JB had seen Ryan in these moods before, and it didn't pay to argue with him. He knew his friend was hurting over the casualties from the night before. Hell, they all were hurting. Jack and Christy were family, and the sudden erasing of their presence still hadn't fully sunk in. Yet out of everyone, JB had known Ryan the longest, and even he couldn't gauge the extent of his grief this time. This loss cut deep. Christy had been Ryan's lifeline, his shining beacon in the darkness. Now, with that light extinguished, there was no telling what Ryan might do. Ryan fell silent once more, trying to work the previous night's sequence of events in his own mind into a semblance of logic. If he was going to lose the woman he loved, there had to be a reason beyond blind, stupid luck and a lost contact mine.
Well, what do we do now?
No way to paddle. No oars. Guess we could swim back to shore.
Well, excuse the hell out of me for not packing oars. I was busy finding us a safe way off the boat.
Too busy to grab some chow?
What? More of those shitty crackers? I didn't see you snatching up stuff in the galley, Dean. You were clinging to Doc's ass with both hands last time I looked.
The lad was merely giving me a push.
Enough! Not another peep, John. That goes for you too, Dean. Doesn't matter who got what and what was left behind.
At least everyone did have the presence of mind to hang on to their blasters.
A lot of good that does us now. Can't eat bullets.
Bullets can chill your scrawny hide.
Bickering isn't going to help a thing.
Dean's right. There's no food, except for the emergency jerky rations in our pockets. No water except what's left in the canteens. Face it, people. We're fucked blue.
Bullshit, Dad. That's not what I meant.
What did you say to me?
I said bullshit. We're not dead yet. You're the one who always told me not to give up until I was 6 feet under. Well, I'm not, and neither are you. So, I'm not. I'm just griping because I'm hungry. And even some stale crackers would taste good right now.
I must be getting old. You're right, son. We're not dead yet.
I do not want to hear a word about you claiming to be old, Ryan. You have no earthly idea.
Well, what do we do?
Nothing for now. What can we do? But I'm not giving up yet.
Ryan was half asleep and wanted to escape by dreaming. His body was drenched in warm sweat. There was no relief from the hellish sun that was now directly overhead and pounding down on the lost and drained group in the raft. In his mind's eye, Ryan was once again in the sea near the rapidly sinking patch, attempting to find Christy and Jack after they'd been lost. But all he was surfacing with was handfuls of water. He couldn't see a thing either above or below the waves, not even where the boat had been before he leaped into the churning waters. He knew his lifeline was secure as long as it was being held by JB, so he went down, diving into the gloom, and reaching out with both hands for an arm or a leg. But there was nothing to wrap his fingers around and save. That was the way the search had ended, with empty hands. A groggy Ryan opened his eye, half closed it again to escape the sunlight. There was no way to cheat this one as he had cheated the odds so many times before. No way to pull a hidden weapon or signal a backup. No way to outthink or outfight a storm. Ryan had no control of nature. No way to smell a hidden bomb while wrestling in the middle of such weather. She was gone. Christy was gone, along with Jack. Ryan could feel no sense of loss for the athletic young albino, at least not now. The loss of Jack would be dealt with in time. Ryan had lost other loved ones and could still summon up an ache in his psyche for them when he dwelled in that forlorn section of his soul. Jack would join other companions that had been sacrificed to Deathlands. His bravery, his courage, his always dependable loyalty wouldn't be forgotten. Still, there was no grief for Jack. Ryan couldn't grieve for his friend until he was able to accept that Christy was no longer going to be at his side, in his bed, in his mind. She'd been swept away, vanished before he even had a chance to look upon her beauty and hold the image in his mind for a last time. And even though his conscious mind wouldn't accept her death, beneath that he knew. The primordial part of every human psyche that stretched back to the dawn of mankind had taken in the full measure of the facts, digested them, and accepted the only logical outcome. Christy Roth was dead. And as he slumped in his own nook of the raft, his lone eyes shining bright with unshed tears, Ryan leaned the blind side of his face against the wet plastic and dealt in his own manner with yet another bad hand dealt to him. Dean was right. He wasn't the kind of man who could just accept defeat without a fight to the death. Ryan Carter dealt with the pain by wanting revenge, even on Mother Nature herself. One way or another, he was going to kill that unyielding bitch. After long hours of misery, the sun fell and night stepped back into place. There was talk and debate, but ultimately no solution to the problem. In the relative cool of the darkness, everyone fell into restless sleep. And this time, minus the rain and the heat, actually got some needed rest during their second night spent in the raft. Everyone succumbed except for Ryan, who saw something that made him feel as though he were experiencing a nightmare. The only difference between this one and the numerous others he'd endured was that he was wide awake. Fearing the worst, Ryan peered intently at the glassy surface while putting his right hand on the butt of his Sig Sauer. If some sort of mutated killer shark or radioactive electric eel or giant crab monster decided to show itself, he had no problem with blowing it away. He wanted to kill something. The placid personality he'd been inhabiting since the boat had gone down was smothering him. He had to rid himself of the grief soon, before it fed upon his own soul and swallowed him up, drowning him just as effectively as the sea had fed upon Jack and Christy. However, he wasn't expecting a human head to raise itself up from the inky black liquid. The back of the head was all he saw. The lank hair from the head was long and blonde, and in a mass of tangled curls that all dripped water. Ryan waited for long seconds until the head turned to a profile view that was human and not human. The being spotted Ryan, then spun completely around for a face-to-face look. As they met each other's gaze, Ryan sensed no fear in the intent of his aquatic visitor, only curiosity. Ryan felt the same way. He'd never seen anything quite like the humanoid paddling patiently in the water next to him. The face was primarily a pair of eyes, oval orbs of milky white, tinged slightly with a coating of lemon yellow. Blue veins were running like a pre-dark road map through the milk, and the pupils were saucer-shaped. Below the twin ovals was a pair of vertical slits and a slight protrusion that might have been a nose, and a half-moon mouth with the corners turned downward. The lips on the mouth were pencil-thin and dark purple, and the skin of the face was peeling in several places, as if the creature had been caught outside unprotected and suffered a slight sunburn. The new skin under the peeled-away epidermis looked shiny and wet, not dry. Ryan decided that he knew what he was looking at. Some kind of water muti.
Sure. Help.
Then, the face was gone, and Ryan was left gazing at himself in the black mirror of the ocean's surface. Late in the second day, as Ryan drifted in and out of a dehydrated haze, he thought he saw movement on the horizon. Not wanting to raise false hopes in the others, he kept quiet and rubbed his good eye, trying to bring what he thought he saw into focus. Dean noticed his father staring and decided to see if his young eyes could help identify whatever had captured his father's rapt attention.
Hot pipe, Dad? You see what I see?
Yes, son. I believe I do.
Looks like people. They're swimming over here.
What's swimming?
The only one of the group who was not staring at the approaching sight now was Doc, who was still asleep, oblivious to the mounting excitement.
Shit. More shipwreck victims. No room in the raft.
Relax, John. As fast as that pair seems to be moving, I doubt they're interested in setting up quarters with us.
The pair of muties stopped their approach about 30 feet away from the boat. The man-like creature that Ryan had seen over the side of the life raft had returned with another of his kind. His companion was smaller. Once or twice, she flashed the group in the raft with an impressive set of breasts that were dotted with the fibrous scales that also covered the male creature's chest. They all felt comfortable terming her as female. A long hour passed and started to spread into a second, yet the creatures wouldn't come any closer to the raft. During that time, Doc had finally come awake and joined his fellow companions in staring at the creatures.
Muties!
Shh! Don't go insulting our rescuers, John. Just because they're choosing not to swim over closer and talk doesn't mean they're deaf.
Rescuers? I think you're giving these two credit they don't deserve. They don't look like they have half a brain between them.
They can communicate.
How do you know?
I heard one speak to me, JB. I was half out of it at the time, but the big one said, help, as plain as day. But that doesn't mean much if they just want to stay where they are and watch us like some kind of free peep show. Hell, they may be waiting for the sun to cook us in the big slabs of jerky so they can have a snack.
Is that what you make of them, Dad? Think they're waiting for all of us to die?
No. My gut says that's not the case. He came back. Came back and brought a friend. No blasters, no blades.
No clothes.
Could be they do want to help us out. I imagine they're just as nervous about us as we are about them.
Such queer-looking mutations almost make one believe in the existence of mythical Atlantis. Perhaps our little raft has crossed over into their realm. Their magical jeweled city could be on the floor of the ocean directly below us. Imagine, Captain. Imagine an entire populace of water breathers. What better way to escape the hellish holocaust that has spread its poisonous fire across all of the lands of the planet?
All in the raft recognized the symptoms. The older man was entering into the mindset he sometimes exhibited after a particularly grueling mat trans jump, or after any other type of strenuous mental and physical activity. Shipwrecked and afloat with no provisions for several days was exhausting to the healthiest of men. And while Doc was as tough as dried leather, even he had his limits.
Doc might not be that far off the beam about our visitors.
What, Atlantis? Sure, Millie. And those two are going to come spurting up to give us a lift back to shore on their dolphins.
Not Atlantis. We're in the wrong part of the ocean anyway. No, I mean what he said about there being no better way to escape the disease, the violence and the mental pain of living on the surface than by going down below, beneath the sea.
Under the sea, dear.
I doubt those two are true amphibians anyway. They've been keeping their heads above water with no problem. They might be able to stay under a long time, but they seem to live on air just as easily as breathing oxygen through some kind of gills. The mutations appear purposely induced.
Ryan recalled some of the horrors he'd seen back when taking a stroll through the Anthills laboratories. They had been generating many of the same sorts of survivalist mutations there.
Could be right, Mildred.
Look at their eyes. I'll bet they're covered with a second protective membrane. That's what makes them so damned pop-eyed.
And then, as if they had heard Mildred's theories, both of the muties' heads vanished beneath the water in unison. The color of the ceiling was industrial off-white. A bare light bulb, shining hot, hung a few inches from the painted surface. There was a roughness in the paint, a kind of swirling pattern. Christy closed her eyes in an attempt to adjust to what she had just seen, then reopened them. The ceiling and bulb were both still there. She was flat on her back and looking up.
Ryan?
Christy turned her head to the right, then left, taking in her surroundings. She was in a small room, no windows, a single closed door with a 12-inch square of glass inserted at eye level. The walls were the same industrial off-white as the ceiling. She glanced down to a carpeted floor. The carpet was well-worn but clean, its color a neutral dark blue. Very unassuming, very unthreatening. Christy tried to sit up, and suddenly the beigeness of the room erupted in a variety of colors, all violent and nauseating. She laid her head back down on the pillow, and the six sensations disappeared. She began a mental inventory. Then she remembered the water. What had brought her to this place? Then she remembered the water, the storm, and the fall into the abyss. Christy lifted herself to a sitting position, this time much slower. The wall stayed bland. She swung her feet over the side of the bed, realizing for the first time that she was barefoot, and let them fall onto the carpet. She was wearing a cotton pair of canary yellow pajamas, a matching set of top and bottom. She was alive and dry, and wearing a man's nightclothes. How she'd ended up here remained to be seen. Christy staggered on her feet as she stepped over to the door, consciously willing the returning small explosions of color to go away. She tried the doorknob, which was locked.
How utterly predictable.
Christy craned her neck and tried to see through the door's viewing portal. Outside was a hall, and directly across from her was a door that appeared to be identical to the one she was now housed behind. Unit 2 was printed on the door in stenciled black paint. No matter how she turned her head, all she could really see was the single door for Unit 2, along with the walls of the hall, which came complete with a silver handrail. After looking at Unit 2, Christy decided that she was probably in Unit 1. She turned back and took in her room. There was an open closet with a pull curtain near the head of the small single bed, and a bare end table stood between the closet door and the bed. She stepped over and pulled aside the curtain to the closet. Empty. She pulled open the drawer of the end table. Empty again.
Enough of this.
Christy balled up one fist tightly and began to pound on the door.
Time for some answers.
Across the hall from Christy in Unit 2, Jack had been awake for the past 2 hours, glaring at the locked door that held him prisoner. There were no hinges to lift, no inside locks to pick. The glass in the door was unbreakable and thick, offering nothing but a cloudy view of a door labeled Unit 1. A realist, Jack had determined that he wasn't going to be escaping through the door anytime soon. He'd turned his bed over in hopes of finding a bit of metal bedding he could use as a weapon, but the beds were of a single piece, cast in curved metal, with a soft mattress stuffed with foam pellets. The pillow was also self-contained, with no zippers or fasteners. Jack had used his teeth to tear it open, only to find more of the same foam pellets. The end table was also a single piece of lightweight metal. The tabletop and drawer were empty and useless. He climbed on the bed and managed to reach the Spartan light bulb gleaming overhead. He took off his pajama top and used it to protect his fingers from the heat, intending to unscrew the bulb, until he realized that doing so would plunge him into near darkness. Jack decided that would be a pointless endeavor, and he stepped back down to the floor and shrugged back into his nightclothes. The pajamas were another reason he was in such a foul mood. Jack hadn't been pleased to find his clothing and weapons taken from him. No Colt Python, no throwing knives, no boots. He was dressed in a pair of deep burgundy pajamas. Jack was miserable. He despised being closed in. So he lay on his bed, a few of the stray foam pellets spilling out from where he had torn open the pillow, and sulked. Until he heard Christie's pounding. That caught his interest. He hadn't thought of knocking to announce himself. Jack got to his feet and pounded on the wall of his room. At the end of the hallway, hidden from the line of vision the secluded units allowed their inhabitants, sat a man behind a desk. The man at the end of the walkway thumbed a comm button and spoke into a walkie-talkie he wore on a belt around his waist.
Both of the visitors are now awake. The sedatives kept them under for the 48 hours, as you requested.
I have research to do. I'll be right there.
Within 5 minutes, Christie's ploy had succeeded. Two men entered her room. One of them was the same man who had first heard her and used the comm unit. He was now wearing a vest adorned with an array of small gadgets and ammunition. He was carrying an AK-47 in one beefy hand, and Christie had no doubt that the man knew how to use it. The second person to enter the room was the one the sec man summoned, obviously a leader from the dress and demeanor. The man was well-built, large, and handsome in a self-assured way.
Ah, our mermaid has come back to us. How do you feel, my dear?
Thirsty.
I imagine so. You've been unconscious for nearly 2 days.
2 days?
You were given a sedative when you arrived. It was decided complete bed rest was the best cure for your ordeal.
A third man came into the room carrying a metal tray. On the tray was a plastic pitcher of water and a matching cup.
Now, this isn't the finest in wine, but I think water is what you need to get into your system now.
The orderly handed the cup of water to the seated Christie.
Oh. Who are you?
The orderly set down the tray and left the room, closing the door behind him.
They call me the Admiral. My chosen name is Poseidon. You may address me as Admiral or Sir. I'm the senior officer here at King's Point. Now, it's my turn. Who are you?
Christie Roth.
You're a very lucky woman, Miss Roth. If my submarine hadn't come along when it did, you would almost certainly have drowned.
Submarine?
Aye, that's what I truly am. A submarine commander. Beneath the ocean at a certain depth, the activities of the surface world become meaningless. We were passing by, and then, the next thing I know, bodies were showing up on sonar.
I owe you a life debt of thanks.
Christie still had a suspicious feeling about her self-proclaimed benefactor, but if what he said was true, then she was beholden to him.
Not at all. Picking you up safely is part of my responsibilities as watchman of the sea.
Where's Ryan?
Your companion? He's across the hall. Would you like to see him?
Christie felt 20 pounds of worry drop away from her body. She was still suspicious of how polite everyone was being, but she had no choice except to play along for now. Perhaps Ryan could help shed some light on what was going on in this place.
Yes, I would. Please.
Poseidon gestured, and the sec man standing behind him exited. He returned in less than 60 seconds, with the person the Admiral knew only as her companion. When the pajama-clad Jack was presented to her, she tried hard to contain her disappointment. She was glad to see her friend, but had hoped that Ryan was the one they were talking about. Still, she knew the others, Doc, Mildred, JB, and Dean, as well as Ryan, had to be around somewhere. Perhaps she and Jack had been the only two injured the night of the storm.
Hey, Christie.
Hello, Jack.
You okay?
Never better. Got a lump on the back of my head, that's all.
Your hair's so big. Helped to protect you.
This is Jack? Jack Ryan?
No, just Jack. Jack Lauren.
So his name isn't Ryan?
No, I'm sorry. I was thinking of one of my other companions.
Oh, too bad. One of my favorite fictional characters is named Jack Ryan. Of course, he's not the striking picture you are, son. No offense.
Sure.
Where are my other friends?
Other friends?
In the boat, where I fell from.
Again, Christy remembered the explosion, the sensation of falling and nothingness. The boat had either run into something in the storm, or a bomb or some kind of grenade had gone off in the hull. Or they had been hit by something on purpose.
I'm sorry, Miss Roth. There were no other survivors.
Christy wasn't buying the story Poseidon was selling. If Ryan was truly dead, she would know it. The bond they shared went way beyond physical. It was mental and spiritual. It even had a bit of mysticism mixed in. Thanks to her mutant abilities and heightened awareness, both of which were returning to her faster and faster now that she was up and around, she just knew. Other than the blow to the head she'd suffered, Christy had experienced no other wounds to either the body or the soul. That's how she knew Ryan wasn't dead. If he had died, the result of his passing would be like having a baseball-sized chunk of her own insides ripped out. Still, the Admiral was in control of the situation. For now, Christy and Jack were going to have to play along. Both were feeling better now that their clothing had been returned to them.
Freshly laundered.
Christy's long black fur coat was missing, but she really didn't mind for the time being. The weather outside was quite warm.
Your coat, along with your Smith & Wesson and other personal effects, are in storage, to be returned when you are ready to leave.
Jack was in the same predicament. His prized .357 Magnum Colt Python and assorted blades, including the hidden leaf-bladed knives, were also being held.
For safekeeping, I wouldn't want you to be distracted from the tour.
A second SEC man with an AK-47 joined the first one, as Poseidon led Jack and Christy out of the base hospital. Christy was surprised at how well everything was maintained. The walkways connecting the various buildings were clear. The grass, and there was plenty of it, was cut short. There were no broken windows or debris. At least in this part of the base. Within her line of vision, buildings could be seen in much worse repair. Poseidon pointed those out first.
In time, those will be restored. It's a miracle this installation survived at all. There was an error somewhere that kept King's Point from being pummeled with nuclear fire during the last dark days of the United States.
Poseidon stopped and saluted a brightly colored red, white, and blue American flag that was snapping above them. The flag was tethered to a white metal flagpole. The two SEC men also saluted, but not as crisply or as intently as Poseidon. Both men kept watchful eyes on their tour group.
We've got electric power for all of these sections.
Poseidon walked them over to a long, high-domed building on the edge of the coastline.
Armory, dormitory, briefing and tactical, hospital, and, of course, the overlook arch for the submarine pens.
As the group passed other men, Christy noticed only a few in proper naval attire similar to what Poseidon was wearing. Most were dressed in an amalgam of various styles of salvaged clothing similar to her own. She spotted leather, denim, cotton, and flannel. The men in the civilian garb were also a striking mix of faces and nationalities, whereas the ones in uniforms were all clean-cut, square-jawed white men.
Why some in fancy duds and others not?
Only enlisted men can attain rank and position. They are the elite who have the sanctioned right to wear the colors and insignia of the Naval Corps. The others, you see, are hired security.
Grunts? Muscle?
Precisely. They are well paid to do exactly as I tell them, with the promise of going higher if they exhibit the type of mind and character I am seeking for my Navy. My followers grow in number each day as word spreads about the opportunity I offer here. I'm constantly amazed at how many men and women are just looking for the chance to improve themselves. There's not much in the field of career opportunities in this day and age.
The group entered the long building. Poseidon led the way down a flight of metal steps to the wide half-enclosed areas open for docking ships or submarines.
This base was originally constructed in the old calendar year of 1979, during the declining years of the James Earl Carter administration. He worked up the base in a grand style as a gift to his home state. Small and attractive, and as you can see, durable.
Carter must have been one double powerful baron.
Not as strong as you think. He ruled for 4 years, then he was replaced with a new baron. His own people voted him out.
Voted?
threw him out, fired him.
Sounds more like a leader of a vill to me.
Don't use ignorance. This took place in the past, yet I still know it. History, you buffoons. Learn from the mistakes of others. I read this in a book in the base library. Most of the old texts were ruined, but one entire wall survived in readable condition, including a set of encyclopedias. Most illuminating.
The Admiral gestured to a small, pale white submarine that had surfaced.
We have a single working mini-sub, the Moth, that comfortably holds a crew of 8, but can accommodate 12 if needed. This is the same craft that rescued you and Jack Ryan, Miss Roth.
Lauren.
Poseidon was playing the role of genial host to the best of his considerable ability, and Christy had to credit the man's gift for gab. He was proud but not arrogant as he showed off his base, his men, and his aquatic toys. Normally such a display would scream ego to her, since she'd been given the grand tour more than once by barons who quickly turned on her and her friends. Even the Sekhmen were a familiar part of the routine. But at the same time, Poseidon seemed genuinely interested in her opinions and comments. What did she think? Did she like this or that? Jack wasn't as impressed as he took in the white exterior tiles of the submarine, peering down over the rail at the tiny craft.
Don't look like much.
You're right, Lauren. Looks like an oblong cake of lye soap floating in a cast iron tub. No, the Moth is only for short-range use. A scientific exploration craft. Not a military issue at all. The real deal submarine is in another berth. And trust me when I say I think you will find it more impressive.
As they stepped over to the sub he was now discussing, both realized that Poseidon had told the truth.
This is the USS Raleigh, one of the elite of the nuclear warships of the world before Skydark. This is a Los Angeles-class boat, 33 feet in diameter for the highest speed capabilities, capable of passing 35 knots when the reactor core is operating at full potential. She comes equipped with the BSY-1 combat system and the MK-32 VLS system for vertical missile launch. Her hull is approximately 3 inches thick and composed of a vanadium and HY-80 high tensile steel mix. She displaces an estimated 6,900 tons.
The group of 5 stepped out on the gangplank on top of the massive submarine for a closer look at the lookout station.
Now are you impressed, Mr. Lauren?
Jack didn't answer as he peered down the front of the deadly steel cigar.
I'll take your silence as a yes. Well, that ends the tour. I can't top the Raleigh.
Don't we get to go inside?
No, you do not. The interior of the boat is classified.
Poseidon nodded to one of the accompanying Sekhmen.
Take our guests back to the wood.
I'd rather have something to eat. I'm starved.
And you shall, but in your rooms.
Not in the cafeteria?
I'm afraid not.
Sound like we your prisoners.
No, but you are my guests, and I always take care of my guests.
Neither Jack nor Christy particularly liked the sound of that.